From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his book, the journalist David Schenck describes getting a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease as a side impact collision of overwhelming force. He tells of one man, a magazine editor, who was 54 when he was diagnosed, who said he walked out of the clinic feeling like a very helpless and broken man. And he said this, "I wondered if there was anything for me to live for," which is a natural reaction. Schenck says we are all the sum of our memories. Today in the program, we're beginning a series of conversations about Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. David Schenck will get us started with the basics. Really, the show is asking, what happens when that thing that defines you begins to fade? Join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. A few years ago, the journalist David Schenck wrote a book on Alzheimer's disease. He called it A Portrait of an Epidemic. And in it, he wrote that we are all the sum of our memories. Everything we know and perceive, every movement we make is shaped by our memory. It's who we are. And so what happens when you lose your memory? What happens to your identity? And not only for yourself, but for those who know you. How does it change their perception of who you are? Just about every single minute of every day, every 67 seconds, someone in the United States will develop Alzheimer's, and that's only one form of dementia. David Schenck is joining us today as we begin a series of conversations about dementia, about how it works, and of course, its impact on individuals and their loved ones. David Schenck, his work has appeared in National Geographic, in Harper, Slate, The New Yorker, NPR, and others. He's the author of six books, including the book that I mentioned. It's called The Forgetting, Alzheimer's, Portrait of an Epidemic. It was the basis, some of you may remember, of a PBS documentary of the same name. Schenck is also the creator and executive producer of Living with Alzheimer's. It's an online film project designed to raise awareness about the disease. We are featuring on our website, Video West, one of the films in our favorite section. We're also launching a series of short films about Herta Saunders, a Utah woman dealing with dementia. She's going to be joining us later on the program, and we'll give you the details about all of that as we go along. A long introduction, but David Schenck, thank you very much. He's joining us from a studio in New York City. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to talk to you again, Doug.
I wanted to there's something you say in The Forgetting early on, and I wanted to start there. You say that only when our brains begin to fail in some way do we really, I guess, appreciate what they're capable of, that we're devastated and in awe. When I guess the question is, do we take our brains for granted?
I really think we do. And it's useful not only in this context, but I think it's useful just generally for human beings to take, if they can, to take stock and step back whenever they get the opportunity and appreciate what this amazing, amazing machine does for us. It's without a doubt the most complex and advanced and developed machine in evolution. Mm-hmm. And it's enabled us to dominate all of life on Earth and, in fact, wield some pretty serious destruction as we're now seeing.
Yeah.
But it does so much for us. And as you just suggested, almost all of it we're aware of when we step back and think about it and observe it, but from moment to moment we absolutely take it for granted, and I think we have to. You wouldn't want to dwell on all the extraordinary things that are going on all the time in your brain, but it is just an exquisite machine. Mm.
There's the story you tell from 1901, the German woman, and not an elderly woman, we should point out. She was only 51 at the time of this story. Her doctor was the man who gave Alzheimer's disease its name. Dr. Alois Alzheimer's, and she comes to see him, and he asks her to write down her name. After three attempts, she couldn't, and she told him this: I have lost myself.
Yeah.
Now, before we get to Dr. Alzheimer's observations and his work, let's talk about that observation, I've lost myself. Is that, because it seems like kind of the perfect metaphor in thinking about all of this, because this is so much a conversation about self and identity, it seems.
Yes, it is. It's an existential disease. I think that's why it's so terrifying to everyone who's heard of it. You really don't need to know much about Alzheimer's to be existentially terrified by the idea that you would start losing your memory, because we don't need to be told on the radio that memories are who we are. I mean, we feel that. We know that. It's an integral part of our identity, our understanding of who we are and our relating to the world. So when you start to lose your ability to form new memories, your ability to connect older memories and plug them into the world that you're navigating, you know, that's a terrifying and debilitating thing.
There, I wanted to ask you, you spend some time in your book talking about the way we've thought about our brains, our memories, in history. What do we know about dementia in the past? Writers and philosophers and scientists, I mean, do we get a sense of dementia as an issue, as a prevalent affliction in history? I mean, it wasn't called dementia then, but certainly you talk about Homer and Aristotle and Chaucer and this whole litany of people writing about it. So surely it was an affliction that people thought about, at least were familiar with, whether they could explain how it worked or not. It was always there, I suppose.
It was always there. This is one of the big questions I wanted to try to answer in my book. And so I spent a fair amount of time digging through historical texts. And since I don't know too many languages, I leaned on the kindness of scholars in other languages and said, here's, you know, you know about dementia and here are the symptoms. And for the time period that you're familiar with, that you're an expert in the particular language or region of the world that you're interested in, are you seeing anything like this in your historical text? And what came back is yes. It's everywhere. And what I was able to – in fact, there's some really remarkable I was able to compile a list of terms in the book and a list of stories. And the bottom line is that as far as I can understand, as long as human beings have been getting old – we have experienced dementia.
Yeah.
And as probably everyone listening knows now, before the 20th century, proportionally, there weren't that many people who actually got to a ripe old age. Yeah. So basically the story in a nutshell is it's always affected a certain portion of people who got to their elder years, but it's never been – and it's always attracted the attention of writers and observers. It certainly has been remarked on as long as there's been writing, but it's never been something that's really taken hold of the culture and grabbed our political awareness and our scientific awareness and all that until we were able to paradoxically get rid of all these other problems that were keeping us from living longer. So it's really this paradox where we've been able to raise the through all these other medical advances, we've been able to help human beings live so much longer in so many cases, and only now are we seeing it in this just extraordinary prevalence of dementia.
I wanted to ask you about the story you tell. This was from 1877, and Mark Twain gets on stage, and he's going to sort of poke fun of Ralph Waldo Emerson on stage. And he thinks he's going to be delightful and people are going to be entertained by all of this. But it really just falls on silence as he starts poking fun of Emerson. Would you tell a little bit about that story? Because this is just one of the characters in history that you write about who's afflicted with dementia, some form of dementia.
Right. So we're talking about two of the earliest American celebrities, really.
Yeah.
And two great, great minds. This is when celebrities were, you know, were really, really interesting people in addition
right.
to being famous.
Right.
Mark Twain and Ralph Waldo Emerson. And to be clear, it's Ralph Waldo Emerson who's the one who's got dementia.
Yeah.
And as far as I can tell, it's awfully darn close to Alzheimer's. Of course, I can't diagnose in history, but the list of symptoms, the way he progressed over time. It's pretty clearly Alzheimer's disease. And so there are a couple of remarkable things about Emerson. One is that he was such a public personality, and he made the decision with his family essentially to stay out there publicly as he had these problems. So it's actually very well recorded. He got to the point where he was giving speeches, which he was very popular in doing, and he got to the point where in just reading a prepared text, he could not follow along. He couldn't remember the sentence that he just read, so he would have to start following with his finger. And then he required his daughter to be standing up there with him to essentially guide him to show him what he had just read and to make sure that he kept going forward. So for this on this particular night, the remarkable fact was that Twain didn't know any of this apparently.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he got up to give what should have been just a remarkable American moment where Twain is being Twain and he's taking one of Emerson's most famous writings and he's twisting it in only a way that that Twain can, and should have brought the house down, should have had Emerson laughing at himself and at Twain and everything. And it was quite brilliant. And Emerson didn't understand it, so he was stone-faced. I think people looking to Emerson, seeing he was stone-faced, also stayed stone-faced. And Twain went home thinking that this thing had just bombed. It wasn't funny, and he owed Emerson an apology. And then he got this note from his daughter saying, "What you need to understand is my father heard the words you said, but he didn't understand any of it at all."
Yeah.
And that's where he is. And that's – it's not that you weren't funny. It's not that it wasn't interesting. It's not that it wasn't appreciated by everyone else. But the subject of your satire just was not able to appreciate the satire.
We'll dig into this question a little bit more. But it's interesting. Emerson himself, you quote him, he mentions that we estimate a man by how much he remembers. Ironic, of course, that it's him that's writing this. So this is the question that so interests me. What happens to the way we think of someone and ourselves when they become forgetful, when dementia begins to overtake them? How does that change our, you know, regard for someone, let alone how we feel about ourselves? We can talk about that in a moment. But when someone starts to get – you write about Reagan, for example, Ronald Reagan – how does that change our perception of someone?
Right. So you're making a really important distinction. You know, what is the dementia sufferer or patient, whatever you want to call them, what are they going through? What are they thinking of themselves? What are they experiencing emotionally and intellectually? And then very different question, what are we thinking on the outside once we understand at least that there is something going on, if even if we don't understand all the details? And it's really, really hard. I mean, first of all, we only in rare cases where you're really intimate with the person and you've been following them along, not just day to day, but almost moment to moment, and you're really able to form a coherent sense of what they have lost and what they still have. Only in those cases can you really have a keen understanding of where that person is intellectually, what their exact disability is in that moment. For the rest of us, we might know that they have dementia and that they might be in the early stages and the middle stages. We might be told that they can't speak well anymore or they're having trouble remembering stuff that just happened. But a lot of it is a guessing game, and that is a really terrifying thing to us also. We're spending a lot of time trying to figure out, is this person the same old person? It can appear that they are very, very much the same old person for many, many years of the disease. That can throw us off. That can lead us to assume that they actually have more ability than they actually have. So that can lead to some fairly awkward situations. On the other side of it, you might see them stumble. You might see something strange happen in a conversation where they're repeating something a story they just told you. And your confidence in their intellectual abilities can plummet, and you might think that they are even worse off than they are. And you're feeling, not only sorry for them, of course, but you're trying to modulate how what your relationship is like with this new person. You know, connect to the to your old relationship and their personality and their essence as a human being, but also not be rude in overestimating their ability. So it's really, really tricky, as I said, unless you are just very closely following where they happen to be in the moment.
Let's go back to Dr. Alzheimer. What did he – so he meets this woman. I mentioned this woman who said she had lost herself. What does he make of the disease initially? I mean, he knew something was different about this woman that I mentioned. She wasn't very old, and he wonders, how is it possible that she's suffering from this affliction of advanced age? And then you write about this moment that where Dr. Alzheimer first looks at the slides of I guess it's her brain. Would you just talk about this moment of realization, what he's seeing and what he makes of this?
Yeah, so this is really one of those moments in time where a number of things come together. It's a time where it's hard to almost hard to imagine now where science now is so specialized. Not only are you a cellular biologist, but you do specialize in a certain protein, you know, of molecular biology, and you're not really interested in the protein that's similar, but not in your field. This is a time where scientists were very, very broad in general because there wasn't as much specialized knowledge. So you could kind of take a very large domain. So Alois Alzheimer was a clinician. He was a general physician. He took care of patients in hospitals. He was the admitting physician for this patient who walked in off the street or whose husband brought her in off the street. And he took care of her for several years. And he noticed right away, as you said, that she had symptoms that were similar to what you see in old people, what we would call, you know, elderly dementia. But she was, as you said, a very young person, 51 years old. And so that caught his eye. And he followed her disease, and she died a number of years later. And the thing that made us now know, you know, his name was that then he, who had firsthand experience with this patient over many years, was also the same person to biopsy her brain and look in through a fairly brand new microscope technology, a new staining technology. So it was also the first time this is really possible. And to see what we now know are the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, which are these we've been talking about for years now, these famous plaques and tangles in the disease, the plaques that get between the neurons and kind of gum up the works and interrupt the conversation between neurons or nerve cells, and the tangles, which are these protein fragments that are getting twisted inside the nerve cell and are essentially killing it, strangling it from the inside. So this is 1-2 punch that's going on that he was the first to identify, and since he could connect it, you know, firsthand to the symptoms, he knew that he was onto something. He wrote it up. He happened to be to have a friendship with Emile Kraepelin, who was the preeminent psychiatrist of all Europe and all the world at the time. Kraepelin paid attention and called it, was the first one to call it this Alzheimer's disease. Interestingly enough, the first group of people who heard about this description laughed them off the stage. Yeah. But eventually, of course, you know, discoveries, if they're true, they find their audience, and that's why we speak of Dr. Alzheimer today.
Would you give us a sense of what is it that's happening with dementia or Alzheimer's? That you write about? I think when you first wrote the book, it was just sort of a not necessarily a theory. I mean, it was advancing along, but this question of the protein beta amyloid, that seems to have been confirmed right now. And I'm wondering what we know right now about Alzheimer's, what's happening in the brain.
Sure. And we have about 6 hours to do this, right?
Right,
to talk about
exactly.
Plaques and
Sorry,
tangles.
That's just...
what we know right now. To keep it short, you're absolutely right. My book first actually came out in 2001, was updated and came out again in 2004. It sounds like a long time. There hasn't been a whole lot. There's been a whole lot of detail that's come along since then. we're certainly a lot closer to understanding it in full and hopefully coming up with some real treatments, which I think are maybe not just around the corner, but we're getting much closer than we were in the past. Yeah. But the essence of what I talk about in the book, the idea of and in fact the essence of what Dr. Alzheimer talked about over 100 years ago, plaques and tangles, that's still true. And the way we understand it now is that your brain makes a substance called beta amyloid, and that actually, I describe it in my book as essentially a toxin that your brain shouldn't be making. Our understanding now is that that's not quite right, and I should correct this in a new edition, because now we think that beta amyloid has a function. I don't want to get sidetracked into that, but it has a function in healthy brains. And what's going on in the dementia patient is that over many, many years' time, before you have any symptoms at all, that beta amyloid production is going haywire, and you should be producing a certain amount of it, and it should be being cleared at a certain rate from your brain. But both the production side and the clearance side aren't working correctly, and so you're accumulating too much of that beta amyloid, and it is then aggregating into these plaques that I just talked about, these kind of gooey, gummy substances that are getting between the nerve cells in your brain. That is confirmed, as you just said. That used to be the amyloid hypothesis, that really this was the first important stage of Alzheimer's that was leading to everything else. There was some contention about that. Not a lot, but some contention about that when I was writing my book. That really now has been confirmed, I think we can safely say. And that's the first thing that happens in Alzheimer's. And then what happens is that the mayhem that causes then spurs the creation of these neurofibrillary tangles, which I described before, which are inside the nerve cells. And those are the things that are actually doing the real damage. We know that because there are some rare diseases that actually you can skip the amyloid part and go straight to the tangle part. The most famous of which now is we've been talking. There's so much in the air now about and conversation now about concussions from sports. I guess most famously, football playing, mm-hmm. where people develop a dementia, and that dementia is actually a tangle dementia. So it's really kind of you're jumping into the middle part of the biology, the pathology of Alzheimer's disease. So it really becomes the same disease. It just doesn't have the same kind of early stages as people who aren't getting it from a concussion. And then I should mention that there's a kind of a third wave of this, which is that both the amyloid haywire production gone haywire, and the neurofibrillary tangles, which are doing a lot of damage, killing all these brain cells all over your brain, are also together causing this inflammatory response, which in itself starts to do just a terrific amount of damage. So it's not the 1-2 punch anymore. It's really the 1-2-3 punch.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about the idea of what we know about how our memories this question comes up all the time. You know, what's the difference between a mild decline in memory, which we all have, you know, and this is the question of, all right, I've lost my car keys and I can't quite remember the name of that guy who was in that movie, or, you know, what's the difference between that and the serious stuff, you know, clinical dementia, I guess, or Alzheimer's. What's great about your book is you explain how a healthy brain works in terms of memory, how sensory input is converted into these, you know, these three basic stages. And we don't need to go through all of that. But I did want to ask you a little bit about how the brain is supposed to work, because there are these are long-term, episodic and semantic, and maybe we don't need to get into all of that. But this idea of what we know now about how memory works, because memory is what it's all about, I suppose.
Indeed. Let me tell you just a couple of my favorite things that I learned that mean the most to me. And really one of the reasons that I wrote this book in the first place is that I realized after there was a kind of a hit you on the head moment where I overheard a conversation and was just really sad and transfixed by by a particular story of Alzheimer's disease. But then I started researching it, and I started realizing that not only are we in the middle of this horrendous epidemic that needs more attention and explanation and awareness, but also this disease, explaining the disease and the progression of it also is an excuse to just understand more about how our brain works and therefore who we are, what makes us human in the first place. You don't have to – you really don't have to have a specific interest in Alzheimer's to really learn from the disease about you know, what's so remarkable about being human. So there's my little preamble. One of the things that people need to know is that they're the great thing about general knowledge about the brain now is that I think practically everyone knows that the brain is made up of all these specialized structures that do different things. So there's a part of the brain that processes what you see and turns that, you know, it makes you able to understand that. There's a part of the brain that helps us plan things. There's a part of the brain that we don't think about at all that regulates breathing and the heart rate and all that. Now, obviously, we have very complex and specialized components to our brains. Well, there's a part of the brain, it's called the hippocampus, that takes the input and it doesn't really help us with our consciousness or our ability to understand what's in the moment. But it does take what we, or at least our brain, thinks is important about that moment and lays down this short-term memory in case our brain wants to preserve it for the longer term. Right. So, you know, there are other parts of the brain that are helping you and I understand one another now and be in the moment. But the hippocampus, which is this little seahorse-shaped structure, and hippocampus means seahorse in Latin. That's how it got its name. It's so, so important, and it's helping me form some memories of this conversation so that 5, 10 minutes from now, an hour from now, 3 hours from now, I'm going to have some, you know, I'm not going to remember the whole thing, you know, sentence by sentence, but I'm going to remember some of the more meaningful parts. And that's going to be the kind of first line of short-term memory that I've laid down in my hippocampus. Later on, as my brain processes that subconsciously, as I think more about it, as I go to sleep tonight and my sleeping brain decides what, you know, memories are most important to save for the next day, a portion of that is going to be then processed into longer-term memory and kind of become more solidified. But the hippocampus, where it all starts. And for better or for worse, the hippocampus is the region really that's first affected by Alzheimer's disease. So we've already talked about the plaques and the tangles. And if you imagine, and I actually did a little animated film that's on the site that you mentioned before, livingwithalzheimers.org, where we showed this in visual detail. If you imagine that these plaques and tangles are accruing in the part of the brain, the hippocampus that I just described, and that's the place that's first kind of getting torn apart. So you can be – that's what explains – you can be having a conversation with someone. They can be 100% who they are to you. Mm-hmm. They can feel every bit, you know, the person that you've known for 50 years. But then an hour later, they might ask you a question that they asked you an hour before. And they have no memory of that. But everything else about them is entirely intact. It's just that ability to lay down those short-term memories is being severely disrupted. And from there, this really is kind of going beyond your question, but just to, I think it's important to finish this this explanation. From there, the plaques and the tangles are then spreading around to different parts of the brain. Yeah. Slowly over many years' time, and that's what explains the different stages of Alzheimer's, where eventually you're really having trouble recalling words, and then eventually understanding some of the moments you're in, and then making plans for yourself, and then eventually the part that, you know, where you've stored your muscle memories and you're walking around, your physical coordination, eventually that part of the brain is affected by the exact same biology. So that's what explains the very stages of Alzheimer's. Now, I've jumped ahead of your question because we're supposed to be talking about memory, so I'll just stop and you can direct me.
Okay. Well, we need to take a break, and when we get back, I want to talk about – because I think the next step in many ways, and I want to get your beyond just talking about how this works biologically – what you're supposed to do with a diagnosis like that, if you're a loved one, obviously for the individual themselves, is it – well, lots of questions when we get back from a break. David Shank is with us. We're talking about – he has a book called The Forgetting Alzheimer's, Portrait of an Epidemic. We're talking about that and the reporting that he's been doing about that. We should also mention that he is the creator and executive producer of Living with Alzheimer's. It's a film project to raise awareness about the disease, and we have a link to that on our website. This week on Video West, we're launching a series of films about dementia with Herta Saunders, former University of Utah professor diagnosed at the age of 61. She'll be joining us later on the program. But we'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about dementia and not only what's happening physiologically, but also emotionally, what it's like to have your mind emptied out by a disease. The journalist David Shank has been writing a lot about this, and he's joining us today to talk about dementia, Alzheimer's, and its impact on individuals and their families. David Shank, let me ask you, when you get a diagnosis, I have to say on some level it seems to many must seem like a death sentence. Is it in some ways? I mean, is it any different, do you think, from getting news of terminal cancer or some other fatal disease?
Well, I guess I have to be straight and first the first answer that really should be that there is no cure to Alzheimer's disease, and it is fatal. And so not to mislead anyone on that front. On the other hand, it's also important to know that Alzheimer's disease is a very, very, very slow disease. If you're experiencing the early symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, you've actually already been getting the disease, or essentially you've had the disease in your brain in one way or another for decades now. So it's not a death sentence in that you are, you know, once you're diagnosed with the disease, your life is essentially over. It could go on for quite some time. It could progress very, very slowly. In Emerson's case, I think it was 15 or 20 years before, you know, from the time that symptoms started appearing to when he died. And that's not uncommon. In fact, in these days, I think that's a lengthier disease is more common than before partly because people are getting it at an older age, partly because nutritionally and in every other way, health-wise, we're healthier, we're more robust. So that can help slow down, stave off the onset of the disease. So and then there's the kind of emotional answer to your question, which is that, you know, it's kind of up to you how you and your family, how you respond to that. You know, are you the kind of person who's going to live life to its fullest and fight back as best you can? And whether you choose to ignore the disability or embrace the disability or something, you know, in some way not give in to what you're experiencing? Or is it just so overwhelming that you shut down emotionally and you kind of begin the emotional death, you know, that in some ways can happen even before the physical demise.
You say that in some ways it's almost like a choice. Here's how you say in the book, you say, will, referring to someone who gets a diagnosis, will they use the time left to get their affairs in order and to prepare themselves emotionally for the long fade? Or will they acknowledge, or would this knowledge only add to the frustration and force them into a psychological spiral to accompany the physiological one? Would you talk a little bit about that, the psychological effects of knowing all of this? I mean, it's – that's got to complicate this story completely.
Absolutely. And I don't want to minimize it. You know, I'm a writer and I have quips and I have lines and, I dash off a thought and then we move on to the next thought. And I don't want people to think that I'm saying that any of this is an easy choice to make, or just you flip a switch, you decide to do something and you have a new attitude. So, you know, please don't let that come through. But fundamentally, you know, how do we respond to life's great challenges? At the risk of just sounding like kind of a meandering philosopher for a moment, you know, in many ways, and I've seen this happen actually in many different cases. Currently, with a great friend of mine, including with a great friend of mine who has Alzheimer's right now. In many ways, you can live your life to an even greater extent after the diagnosis. You know, what is living anyway? It's relationships. Yeah. It's feeling. It's being honest to yourself and to the world. It's embracing challenges. It's doing the things that you want to do. You know, trying to minimize the fear that keeps you from doing things that you're afraid of doing. So, you know, yeah, I think that there are amazing challenges there. It's an overwhelming truth. It's tough on it's very tough on the family and friends. A lot of this depends on how they react to the disease, to the diagnosis, and to the symptoms. But I think the answer has to be, it doesn't have to be a death sentence, you know, emotionally, if you don't want it to be. It can be, in fact, a new chapter of your life, and there can be many, many very meaningful years of very rich relationships with this disease.
Herta Saunders, who we'll meet here in just a few moments, she talks about in this short documentary that we've produced, the first in this series that we're producing. She talks about letting family and friends, essentially letting love, fill the vacuum of that other part of our identity. So embracing the realities of what's going on, and letting. You know, letting people help, letting people reach out, and I think that's the way she put it. Letting love sort of fill the vacuum. I'm guessing in the stories that you hear people like that really are just acknowledging the realities of the situation they have, and in some ways making their lives even more meaningful than they had been at the time.
I think that can be true. You know, I'm almost 50, so I know what middle age feels like, and I can't speak about experiencing dementia, but I can speak about experiencing what it's like to go from being a young person, you know, where you just have all the dreams and hopes in the world and all this promise supposedly, to a point in your life where even if you're living out your dreams, which I in many ways am. You know, your life has a certain shape. It has a certain, you know, there are all sorts of boundaries and fixtures and limitations and the imagination of what you're going to become and how you're going to change and what else you're going to do. You know, that starts to narrow in a very real way. And that can be overwhelming emotionally. And I think a lot of people, by the time they get to their 50s and 60s and of course later, can succumb to an emotional and physical limiting of how they imagine themselves and see themselves in this world. And so what I've seen quite often is people who have experienced that before dementia, and then they have the symptoms of dementia, there's a diagnosis, family and friends rally around them, and that can be as you just suggested, an opening.
Yeah.
And their lives can suddenly emerge and become richer in many ways. It can be a doorway to renewed relationships, to saying things that you've never said before to people, to wanting to experience things that you may not have time to experience, you know, for too much longer. To experience the feeling of vulnerability and to share that with people and to have to experience the richness, the fear of that, the terror of that, but also the richness of what that's like. So there's a lot of life in there. I've seen it. I've seen it up close.
The question comes up from time to time: what can I do? Does my diet or my lifestyle, does that play a role in any of this? And you say it's not irrelevant. I mean, there, as you say, there's no cure yet. Back in June, though, you wrote this response to what you saw as these kind of misplaced hopes. People saying things like, you know, marijuana is going to stop Alzheimer's, and cayenne pepper cures, or coconut oil cures, or diets with no gluten or carbs or whatever. And then there were those memory exercise apps. Would you put those in perspective? Because I think that's something that worries you.
Sure. Yeah. This is really important. Thank you for asking about this. And there are a couple of points to be made here. The first is that in no way am I saying that diet and lifestyle do not matter. We actually now know that that you can limit your risks. There's no recipe for preventing dementia, but we know that you can lower your risks by doing all the things that doctors have been telling us to do for God knows how many hundreds of years, all the same things that are consistent with heart health and frankly, emotional health, being engaged in the world, exercising, getting enough sleep, you know, having a low-fat diet, and yes, a diet that doesn't have too many simple carbohydrates. All these things that we're hearing about that nutritionists are talking about are also good for lowering our risks with Alzheimer's and the other dementias. At the same time, the reason I wrote that piece is that as long as I've been in this field, I've seen people come up and grab at one or more of these things, and usually they're just grabbing at one of them, and they're being a little loose with their language, to put it kindly, and they're suggesting that if you just take this one diet seriously, or contribute to this one cause, or put this certain kind of cayenne pepper in your tea or whatever, that's the key to not getting dementia. And all of those things are patently false. And not only are they misleading, but here's the most important point. People need to know that we can cure this disease if we funnel the resources to the serious research that's actually going to understand it better and stop it. I'm more confident in that than I've ever been. I'm very involved with a group of terrific scientists at a place called Cure Alzheimer's Fund, led by one of the preeminent Alzheimer's scientists, Rudy Tanzi at Harvard. And so I know, and I work with a lot of these people, and I know that we can actually do this. The problem is resources, and the problem, frankly, is public attention. And every time someone says, well, what about this thing, you know, this new kind of diet that might prevent Alzheimer's, or what about, you know, smoking a little pot to, you know, to maybe prevent Alzheimer's, because there's this one study. That's all fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't go very far if you actually want to stop the disease. And I want people to understand how big this disease is, how terrifying it is, how it's going to decimate our economy and our society, and how we all need to pay attention to it and put the dollars in the research that's actually going to stop it. You can hear how animated I am about the subject.
We're going to have you back on as we talk a little bit more about all of this in the coming months. David Shank, author of The Forgetting, creator and executive producer of Living with Alzheimer's. It's a film project to raise awareness about the disease. We have a link to it on our website. David joined us from a studio in New York City. David Shank, thanks very much for taking the time.
I really enjoyed it, Doug. I always love talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. Talk to you again soon. This week in Video West, we're launching a series of films about dementia, Herta Saunders. We're following her journey through all of this. Former University of Utah professor, diagnosed at the age of 61. You can go to videowest.org for that. We'll talk to Herta when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2010, Herta Saunders was 61 years old, teaching English and gender studies at the University of Utah, and she was having some memory problems. but then came a diagnosis, not Alzheimer's, but microvascular disease. It's a precursor of dementia. And as her symptoms worsened, she knew that she had to retire and reimagine her life. Herta Saunders served as an associate director for the university's gender studies program. She wrote a piece called My Dementia for Slate back in 2014. She's in the process also of completing a book. And we're featuring her on a series of short documentaries on Video West, and she's joining us now in the studio. Herta Saunders, welcome to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
When you received the diagnosis, there's a story that David Shank tells of a man named Bill who received a diagnosis, and there was this moment when he said, I wondered what the point of living was anymore. When you received your diagnosis, did any of those thoughts occur to you?
Actually not. And I think it's for the reason that David Shank discussed, is that by the time you get a diagnosis, you have lived actually with a disease for quite a while. And I have been aware of my something seriously wrong with my memory for probably three years at least before I sought a diagnosis.
So how did you react? What was the emotional reaction? I know you well enough to know you're an extremely logical person, but strip that part out of it if you can. You probably can't. The emotional part, just the gut reaction emotionally to the diagnosis, the confirmation of that sense of something happening.
Yes, it does make a difference to have a diagnosis. It's to me similar to people living together for 10 years and then they get married and they say it makes a difference. In some way, the public affirmation of a state of affairs makes you understand it in a different way. I remember that the day that I actually had the diagnosis and saw my neurologist for the first time, Peter and I sat at home afterwards talking about it, and we both cried a little bit. But for me, it was the grief of other people that made me sadder than anything I experienced on my own. And that came out to when we told our children, although we had already told them before, they knew that I was having memory difficulties and we'd had lots of laughs about senior moments, but they knew that was this probably more than a senior moment. But for them too, the fact that there were lesions visible on an MRI made a difference. And we did. We're not a tearful family. We, you know, shed a few momentary tears blinking, then we hug each other and we
move on.
We move on.
Yeah. There's this lovely thing you say, and it's featured in the film, when you talk about being an immigrant, you create a wider scope of family. And this was something I was mentioning to David, where you talk about the fact that you're letting – it's like they're – your lack of memory, your declining memory is creating this void, but you're letting it fill with something else, and that's with community, with people. Would you talk about that?
Yes, that's true. In South Africa, where I'm from, I was or am still part of a close family of six siblings. And for me, the notion of family is something very close. People who get together, help each other in everything, talk about everything, and we're a very voluble family. And when we emigrated, there was this huge lack of that deep connection to people. So people have been very important for me in my former self as a new immigrant. And I've made an effort over the years, and I've also been very fortunate in discovering friends who have become family. So now that I am more dependent on other people, my community is extraordinary. A friend of mine, Kirsten Scott, picks me up every Friday morning and we go and have breakfast and we talk about, among other things, my dementia, but mostly not. So that, and my family too, we don't dwell on it, but they're there for me in ways that makes me know they have noticed that I might need more help, and just more cheer and more conversation, and just continuing the love we've had for so many years together.
Have you come to see, I know you have such a scientific mind, and I'm wondering, have you come to see the way memory works differently in any way? Shank says we're a sum of our memories. That's essentially what forms our identity. But now that yours is fading, does it make you think about it in any way differently?
It does. I've always been perceived by you two as a calm and logical person. And that is really how I've built my self-image. And I've given much more thought to that other part of my life that I have kept under wraps to a great extent, except to my very closest people. That is becoming more important as my intellectual ability is definitely slowing down and takes more energy to maintain. So I've never felt that I didn't have that part, but I am feeling much more that I'm living in that moments of connection to people, whereas my previous connections were very often with ideas and books and so on, and with people. But now all my energies almost go into people, and it just sustains me on this level of wonder at I almost want to be Carl Sagan-like and say that wonder of the universe and these human beings that we are, who came out of it, and that we can be like that to each other, mind to mind. And I dwell in that.
Herta Saunders, her piece My Dementia was featured on Slate. She's writing a book about her experiences. And as I said, she's the focus of the latest short film on Video West. It's the beginning of a series of portraits of Herta and her family and the friends that surround her with love. I should also mention we're featuring a short film from the Living with Alzheimer's in our favorites section. It's called A Place Called Pluto. You can see all of that at videowest.org. Herta Saunders, thank you for being
Thank you so much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Tim Slover. Video West, produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.